Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, June 19, 2014. Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever you want to and wherever you want to. When you do a free 30-day trial, you'll get a free audio or a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/GWH Radio. This is Michael Morris, and I am joined by my three amigos, Jay West, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
Very good, sir. How are you?
Hanging in. Sorry for last week's, not being able to do last week's show, but I developed shingles over the weekend before last. See, that's what happens when you go on a road trip with Bobby Simmons and Charlie Smith.
Tell you what, Mike, you've had your share of problems here. It's time for somebody else. Not that I want them, but I think somebody else needs to take to the front of the line there.
Well, I'm ready to let them have it, I tell you.
Would any of y'all like a border for about 6 months?
Uh-oh. No, my cats wouldn't want to give up their space. I'm sorry.
I understand.
I think he's going to go back to work, Bobby.
Do what?
I think he's about ready to go back to work.
He is.
Sounds like it.
I don't even know he's here half the time. I come in at night, he's in the bed. I'll tap on the door and speak to him, and that's pretty much the extent of our conversations 3 or 4 days a week.
And Bobby's
between working in church and him getting in there. And listen, I'm going to tell you something, fellas. Y'all wouldn't believe the amount of research this man does on the wrestling business. I just... Every night I look in there, he's on that computer and he's researching pictures and looking for things. And I mean, I love this business and I love y'all, but there ain't no way I'd spend that much time researching y'all.
Well, I don't think it's a business, you know. It's with Mike, it's something else. I'm not
sure
what the psychiatrist would call
there
it.
There you
but...
go.
Yeah, anyway, I've seen a couple of patients.
I don't have money to do with it, anything about it, so.
I've seen a couple of Facebook pictures here, Mike, and I will say that you are looking good, son. I'm glad to see that.
Well, I went last week when I went to have my shingles looked at. I weighed myself. I'm down to 235 pounds from 377. So I just it needs to taper off. Now I'd like to get down to about 220-225 and just taper off it, because I'm just worried that I'm not getting the nutrition that I'm supposed to, and there's no telling what they'll try and do to me if they discover that. They've talked about putting a permanent stent in my body and me giving myself vitamin shots and all this, and
You've got some other surgery that you've got to do, right?
Yeah, that's kind of up in the air right now. I went to the surgeon that did the initial surgery, and I don't want to bore everybody with all the details, but he scheduled me for the middle of July to do the reattachment, but he wanted me to see a gastro doctor that he's in practice with before, to give me the go-ahead before we officially scheduled the surgery. Well, the gastro doctor basically told me I should just leave it alone, not do anything. And I did not care for his whole manner, the way he approached, the way he dealt with me, his whole, outlook on everything. I didn't care for it at all, because basically what he told me was, you're lucky to be alive. You should just stay like you are and don't worry about it. And I'm like, that's
well, I agree with
fine.
Him, man. I will agree with the first part of that statement based on several months ago, but I wouldn't go along with the second part.
But in researching everything and talking to people, once you have something like this, you come across people that have had, you know, similar things that you didn't know had this stuff.
Right.
My attorney's father has had something very similar, and he actually had more removed from him, small intestine-wise and colon-wise, than I have. And he's, you know, he had his reversal done, and, you know, it took a little bit of experimenting to get him the right, you know, balance of medication and everything, but he's fine. He does everything he wants. He doesn't have any kind of, you know, problems like this doctor told me. So I'm going to get a second opinion, third if I have to. But I've also got to find another surgeon because the surgeon that did the initial, the only hospital he works at is not in my insurance network. So I would have to pay for everything out of pocket, and I'm just not going to do it, you know.
I don't blame you.
So I'm trying to line up here in the next couple of weeks, not only going back to see my regular doctor for a follow-up on my visit last month, but also he's got a gastro doctor that he works with, so that I hear is very good. So,
well, I'm sure you can find some barber out there that'll do it for you. So,
oh yeah. I'm thinking about getting a pair of pruning shears and a stapler and doing it myself. But I don't know. But anyway, that's enough medical talk. I don't even play a doctor on TV, so I certainly don't know. But I'm very. I told my daughter the other day I have felt better the last couple of days, and I went made a trip to Mobile this weekend and went through the court thing. So everything is pretty much done there. It's just a matter of the official order coming out, so everything starts, you know, resolving itself with that. And with that load off my shoulders, I have felt better the last 2 days, you know, mentally than I have in I guess over a year.
Well, that stuff can really get you down, I know that.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of that has been weighing into the way I've been feeling otherwise. Probably part of the stress is probably what caused the shingles. So, but anyway, so all that's behind me, and I get to enjoy my time.
You'll probably get depressed
again
when the UPS man delivers the room and board bill. I couldn't tote it myself. I had to get somebody with a hand truck.
That's right. Charlie Smith said he'll help me pay it, so.
Yeah.
That's the official Charlie Smith mention for the evening.
Yeah, well, no, me and Mr. Smith are making a road trip this weekend.
Uh-huh.
We're hitting the road again tomorrow. Louise kicked a little bonus in for me to get him away from her for another weekend. So we're going up to Kingsport, Tennessee tomorrow and attend Bo James TV taping.
All right. You guys have been spending a lot of time together here. I'm starting to wonder about that a little bit.
Well, listen, Louise pays very well.
Is this the show?
And he can't hear anymore, so you can just say what you want to.
Is this a show that Mac McMurray has something to do with?
I don't know. Well, I don't know if Mac will be there or not. Actually, they're doing a part of their show they're doing this weekend. He tapes 3 or 4 weeks worth of matches. He has a 30-minute show up there, so it's only 7-8 matches that he has. But he the gist of his thing is celebrating Jimmy the Boogie Woogie Man, his
Jimmy
50
Ryan.
Years in the wrestling business.
Oh.
And part of the deal was we were going up because we both, have worked with him, and they were going to just surprise him with some people that had worked with him in the past coming up. But he, Bo told me last night, he had to have a little procedure done medically today as well, so I don't think he's going to make it over to the thing. So we may celebrate Charlie's 100th year in the business. So.
Anyway, you're getting out of the house.
In his 40s. Well, what our subject for tonight, and I wanted to talk about well-known feuds and rivalries in the wrestling business, and I guess for Georgia, and you guys will know this better than me because you had more access to see the Georgia wrestling in the 60s, But I would say for the 60s, the one I always read about in the magazines and was always aware of was Gunkel and Fuller against the Assassins, seems to be the big feud in the 60s here, at least for Atlanta. Columbus, from what I remember having lived in Columbus, you know, in the early to mid-60s, it seemed to be Mario Galanto and Bad Boy Hines seemed to be, or Billy Boy Hines seemed to be the big feud there. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of that, but you guys remember.
That's correct.
Well, the big one in Atlanta in the 50s that my uncle talked about so much was Blassie and Gunkel. That was a pretty hot thing. But you know, the one I remember as a kid, the big feud when I first started going to matches or shortly thereafter, the biggest feud that I remember was Stan Stasiak and Joe Scarpa.
Really?
That was the first loser leave town match I ever saw. But, yeah, that was a big deal. I mean, it went on for weeks.
Think about how many matches those two had up in New York when Scarpa was up there as Strongbow.
Oh, yeah.
Stasiak, of course, was a perennial up there. I guess going into the 70s, and it it was a biggest part of it was in Florida, but it really carried all over the country, was Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. when Dory was the world champion. That seems to be the one that got the most press. I know they had matches here in Atlanta. They had matches, of course, in Florida and Amarillo, and they carried it into Charlotte and probably St. Louis. So,
well, you know, the fans probably saw something that they would never have seen right after All South was formed, and, of course, the Atlanta booking office was trying to do whatever they could do to, you know, get the fans to stay with them. On TV, they had Jack Briscoe versus Dory Funk Jr. in a 15-minute television time limit match. And, you know, that was pretty unprecedented to see guys like that won the sitting champion against the number one contender on TV. I mean, you might see them do an interview but not actually go into the ring, or you might see one against a somebody that did not have a big reputation, and then the other guy being outside the ring. But that match actually took place on TV going to a time limit. And, of course, shortly after that, of course, they had the main event with the two guys at the auditorium.
Who did Funk beat for the title? Did he beat Kaniski, or did Kaniski beat him?
No, it was Funk, Kaniski.
He beat Kaniski. When Kaniski first got the title, they did the thing all around the country with Lou Thesz. I can remember in Atlanta, the something that was never done, they put tickets on sale for that match. They made such a big deal out of it. They put tickets on sale for that match way in advance and went up on the ticket prices. You know, they made the deal that Paul Jones had been able to secure the contract, and it was the first rematch, and blah, 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 blah. And as a kid, man, I couldn't wait. We bought our tickets early, and we just couldn't wait to get there to see it. And it was, you know, of course, they went an hour Broadway, I can sit here in my mind and still see that match. I mean, they worked, Kaniski works the short arm scissors for about 35 minutes on Thesz. And, I mean, just, you know, those kind of matches, of course, people that don't know the business would poot at today, because they were wrestling, they were on the mat, and they were working to get out of a hole, and boom, 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 and then back to the hole again. But I can remember that. Every time the title changed hands, it seems like you had that dance all around the country.
Right. Actually, right after Kaniski lost the title, and I was just starting to watch TV on wrestling again, in 68, around in there, he came on TV under a mask. And I forget who he wrestled on TV, but it was a contender. And, of course, the mask was taken off of him after the match or during the match. I want to say it was Doug Gilbert, but I can't swear to it. But he was Kaniski was going around, you know, helping to promote the new title holder. And the idea was that the number one contender, of course, had just beat the last champion right there on television. And so that was something was done. Talking about raising the prices, I remember at the auditorium when they had a world title match, and that was when, you know, it was $5 for ringside. And they had what they called a gold circle deal one night where they actually charged, I want to say, $25 for the ringside seats. And this is when, for the first three rows, and that's when it was either 20 or 25, and that's when seats were going for $5. So, yeah, that was definitely promoted as a big deal.
You mentioned Doug Gilbert. He had a long-running thing with the Assassins as well, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
The deal about him, he originally was a heel and partnered with them, and then they split, and he kept going through a succession of other partners trying to beat them, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Bobby Shane was pretty much his number one partner at that time.
The night that he took his mask off, the deal was he was supposed to, he said he would beat both of them in an hour.
That's right.
And he beat Tom at about 25 minutes, and then Jody rolled in the ring, and they went through. And at 60 minutes, it's a draw. Of course, he didn't beat both of them. You know, the referee raised both guys' hands. And, you know, as a fan, you think, well, that's it. You know, it's over. And I can remember him taking the microphone, and he said, I promised if I didn't beat him, I would take my mask off. He said, and they didn't take it off of me. He said, but I didn't beat both of them in an hour. And he reached up, unlaced it, and took it off. And, of course, I was a kid. I didn't know who Doug Gilbert was, you know. But it was just I can remember that. I mean, just these things, it's funny. We've talked about it. You're in the ring thousands of matches over your career, and you can't remember 990 of them. But as a kid going to the matches, I can remember things that happened almost vividly. I mean, that's how much I loved it, and it stuck in my head.
You know, and another thing about even thinking about that match, you know, a lot of people that watch TV wrestling every Saturday wouldn't miss it for anything in the world and would talk about it and talk about it, never actually went to a live match.
Yeah.
What they got was from TV. So what they would wait for the next week was to, you know, see what kind of results they could get from the last live show, because you got very, very little coverage of it in the newspapers.
Right.
And I can remember that event that you're talking about, Bobby, wanting to know, you know, what happened in that match the next day. And, you know, of course, Gilbert was on TV without the mask. But that was a very, very big deal.
Yep.
Tom and Jody brought
it. If you're going to talk about feuds now, you know, I mean, you know, they had some in Columbus, like Billy Boy against Don Carson and Galento and Billy Boy, and that is local, you know. And of course, all of Gunkel's feuds were in Atlanta. He didn't take it outside of Atlanta. But to me, a feud, the greatest one I ever was around and didn't see that much of it because of the situation was with Ted Oates and Wayne Cowan.
Cowan.
They did it everywhere.
All over every building we worked in.
Everywhere. And Bobby can speak more on to that than I can, because I was with the other group, and of course Bobby was with that
group. I will tell you how good it was. You can and Charlie Smith can attest to this. You know, they would run in on each other. Even if they wasn't wrestling each other, they'd run in on each other.
Right.
I mean, it was the police in Atlanta thought it was a shoot. They'd see one of them come off the stage, and they'd say, oh, here the SOBs go again. And they would, the police would get involved in pulling them apart. I mean, it was the darndest thing you ever seen.
To me, that's the way it should have been. That's the closest thing to that, and it wasn't is what that was Spears and Soto.
Yeah.
I had that one written down that I was going to mention, because it was a little before that one. But, I mean, here were two guys that weren't really main eventers, at least not on their own, you know. And they took that that feud, Soto and Spears, all over the state, and they did every different kind of match you could possibly do. I mean, a boxing match I saw at the sports arena one night with them were No Stopping for Blood, Texas Death Match, Falls Count Anywhere, I mean, those guys worked 120% every time they got in the ring with that feud.
You know, the thing with Ted Wayne, Ted Wayne's ended kind of when the split ended. You know, I mean, I don't know that they ever got together again anywhere else and did it. I don't remember them doing it here anymore. But I'll tell you something else. That thing with Soto and Spirit, that thing went on for years.
Yes. Yes. Even, you know, it went on before the split, after the split. I mean, it did. Did they ever do that in Alabama, Mike?
No, they were never in Alabama at the same time. Now, Spears had a long-running thing like that in out of Mobile with Ricky Gibson. And same situation, you know, they'd work each other every night, months, and then, you know, a couple of years it passed, and one of them would leave the territory, and then, you know, if they happened to be back in the same, or the territory at the same time, then it just took right back up. In Mobile, the biggest feud, of course, in the 50s and early 60s, the biggest thing there was Lee Fields and Mario Galinta. But from what I witnessed, you guys, excuse me, my voice is cracking, was Bob Kelly and Don Fargo. Those two beat each other to death for months on end. I mean, both of them looked like hands because Bob and Fargo loved to work stiff anyway. So they just, you know, hard ways every night and everything else. But what I didn't realize until I started digging into the history of the Gulf Coast Territory, their feud actually started in 1966 when Fargo was Jack Dalton in Louisiana and Kelly was nothing but a referee. And the Daltons didn't like the way he refereed and all that stuff, and they would, you know, jump on him after a match. So that went from there until the final, the best blow-off of any feud I've ever known was in when Kelly decided to leave the Gulf Coast Territory and at the end of 75. And they had a retirement night for him, even though he wasn't retiring. He was just moving back to Louisville to live, be close to his mother who was ill, and he worked for Bruiser and he worked for Nick Gullis. But they did what they did is main event of his last match, last night there. The week before he left, they made an announcement before the main event that Kelly was retiring, and they wanted the fans to choose who his last final opponent would be, and they chose Fargo. And they were, you know, one of their typical matches where they were just beating each other to death, but Bob Sweetan did a run in and jumped on Kelly, and Fargo saved him. And they shook hands and left the ring together. But those two worked together for almost 10 years, just beating each other. But that was the major one I saw.
Another pair up I never saw anything other than pictures of was in Florida, probably around that same time. It was Eddie Graham versus Sputnik Monroe. And I understand they had a feud very, very similar to that. And some pictures that I've seen, just stills, look like they pretty well worked the same kind of deal where it was just beating each other to death every night.
Graham and Malenko, too. I mean, they had every kind of match imaginable, with Russian chain matches and Texas death matches and H-out matches and all that stuff. Probably, and you guys, if you think of one, It did last longer, let me know, but I think the longest-lasting feud in the history of the wrestling business had to be the Sheik and Bobo Brazil.
I would pretty much agree with that. And that was one that perpetuated it was, they mostly probably Detroit, which was the Sheik's home area, but they took that feud on the road. And California, a few other, some other places.
That's
and
Toronto, yeah.
Yes, and, it was a moneymaker. I would imagine most of those matches didn't last very long. considering who you're looking at. But it was a match that, particularly when fans had read about it, seen pictures of it in the after mags, it was something that they'd pay to see.
Yeah, because Bobo chased the U.S. title for, I think, the Sheik held it 7 years straight and then finally lost it to Bobo after Bobo chasing it for that long. And, but you're right, they did that one in Los Angeles, I think, Detroit, Toronto. I think they did it in D.C., maybe Boston or Baltimore for Vince Senior. I guess the only one that I can think of that comes close and really doesn't count would be Dagmar and Diamond Lil, but they did for a long stretch there in the 60s. They were the only two midget girls working, so they didn't have a choice but to work with each other.
That's right. That would make a long feud, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Jerry, in the 60s, of course, this would be you going to the matches in Columbus, and I don't know how much they carried this stuff over. Did they ever do the Fuller and Galento feud in Columbus?
No.
No, that was an Atlanta thing.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure I saw Fuller there once or twice, but, I mean, it was just, you know, as far as him and Gunkel going anywhere here in Georgia, that wasn't.
Gunkel would go to Savannah because he liked to go to the beach, but.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking they did a big long feud here in Atlanta with Fuller and Galento. They did a long feud here with Sputnik and Fuller. When Sputnik first came in, he had Jet, his brother Jet, with him as his manager, and they did a deal at the auditorium where Fuller put that leg lock on Jet and broke his leg because they were getting rid of the manager thing, and Sputnik put a bounty out for anybody to break Fuller's leg, and they had Dick the Bruiser come in, and this one and that one, but then it finally got down to Sputnik and Fuller, and I think that run a pretty good course until Sputnik showed up drunk one night and they fired him. But I know that probably comes as a great shock to y'all. You mentioned the Assassins having a feud with Gunkel and Fuller. Man, they had that big feud in Florida with the Assassins and the Kentuckians, and they brought that here and tried to duplicate it, but it just never clicked here like it did there.
I think people here were used to seeing the Assassins go against more what I'd consider scientific or skill type.
More wrestlers rather than the big brutes. Yeah, I agree.
And that's what the people were used to seeing. And they would, Jody and Tom could work a really great match against that type of combination as their opponents. And not that they couldn't work with anybody, because they could, but that was the type match you wanted to see, which would end up being, an all-out brawl by the end, but it would be a legitimate style match rather than just a couple of big guys getting in there with them from the beginning and only going a few minutes.
Well, Jerry can probably speak to this better than me since he wrestled a whole lot more than I did. But Georgia was a wrestling territory. That's what people wanted. They did not want that.
That meat chopping.
No,
you know,
they didn't want it.
It was not a meat chopping territory. And even when Ted and Cowan was doing all that feuding, they wrestled.
Yes, they did.
Except when they'd have a whatever kind of match. But another good one, which involved tons and tons of wrestling, was Dickie and Jody.
Yes.
With that nerve hold.
I was going to ask that one. Was that one an actual long program, or did they just have a handful of matches?
No, it was long.
Yeah.
Yeah, this stretched out.
It started in the Atlanta office, and then it went to All South. And I'm pretty sure they had a couple of matches after All South.
Oh, yeah, after it ended. See, the deal was, when Dick started that, Jody was in Japan.
Yep.
Or maybe Jody was here when they started it, and Jody left and went to Japan.
Right, supposedly.
And when he came back, he knew the nerve hold.
That's right.
That was the deal.
Yep. That is correct.
And, going back before we get too far away from it on that Soto Spears thing, too, I was in the ring a lot of times with Wayne and Ted. I mean, those guys, you talk about wrestling and working hard. They were both Ted's a little older than me, and Wayne's a little older than me. I'm a couple, 3-4 years. It's not much. But those guys, you know, we were all kids. Pretty
Ted
good.
Was young.
Yeah,
he
I mean, we were kids.
Any time, Bob.
And these guys were killing each other, and they were so excited to be. I don't know if important's the word, or prominent, or being put out for a little bit. I mean, they were thrilled, and they were killing each other. And me and Ted's talked about this. I refereed a match one night in Savannah where they did a double knockout, and they cracked Ted's. Wayne thought he was at home on at his grandmother's or something, and Ted's eyes were rolled back. And I'm standing there looking at him, and I'm thinking, God, if they don't come around and figure out what's going on, this is fixing to get real ugly. And fortunately,
they
both, you know, snapped out of it. But, I mean, it was crazy. They were killing each other.
And that was every night.
Yes, sir. And it didn't matter if it was a big building or a little building.
Here you would see two guys that were used to being kind of, you know, low on the card. And they were seeing themselves build it so that as they looked at the placards for the coming weeks, their match was going up. You know,
yep.
It was moving up towards semifinal and in some places main event. And here, you know, against very much more seasoned guys that were main event workers. And, you know, that obviously had to be, you know, quite a thrill for them at that stage.
And how would you like to follow that?
Oh, yeah.
That's
and, you know, they wound up doing a thing in Columbus where Wayne shaved his head. They did a hair versus something match. I forget what it was, but they wound up Wayne shaved his head. I mean, it was a wild time. But that on top of the Spears thing and the Soto, I can remember I was putting the ring up, and running errands at the TV, you know, doing the TV station, putting the ring up, doing different things. And I can remember these guys just. I mean, it was just you didn't know what was going to happen when these two guys got together. And then the split came. I came back 2 years later working for Barnett referee, and now all of a sudden I got to be in the ring and up close and watching those two guys. And, man, that was some crazy stuff. I mean, it was just you never knew what was going to happen.
But you know who, even though, you know, the four, you know, talking about Spears and Soto and then Ted and Cowan, but you got to attribute all that to one person. That was Tom Ernesto.
Tom Ernesto, and both of those started in an opening match on a card.
Mm-hmm.
Tom seen them work together, and Tom had that vision. He knew.
He knew.
He knew.
And Ted, he loved working with Wayne Cowan, and I had never worked with Cowan until we went to Kansas City, and he. And Ron Bass showed up out there, and we worked a lot with them. And I just, it's one of those deals. Him and Cowan click. That's all I can tell you. But I didn't enjoy working with him at all. He was herky jerky to me, you know. Bobby, you know what I'm talking about. You were there. He was.
Yeah. The first match I ever wrestled in, I ever actually got in a ring and wrestled somebody. I wrestled Wayne Cowan.
You kidding me?
Somebody didn't show up one night, and me and Larry had taken the ring somewhere. I don't even remember where we were. And Jody Hamilton looked at me and he said, "You got your stuff with you to wrestle?" And I went, "Yeah." And I wrestled Wayne Cowan. That was my first one. And then my second match, I was in Augusta one night and somebody didn't show up. Ernesto told me, he said, "Go get your stuff on." And I worked with Cowan a second time. Of course, I was a thrill just to be in the ring. I was just listening. You tell me what to do, Bub, and I'll do it. And you know, but yeah, he was not what we consider to be smooth. It wasn't smooth. It was sort of.
It was. I'm not saying he couldn't work. It was just he was. I don't know. But Ted had great matches with him.
Yep.
You know, that's just the way it works. That's the way it works sometimes.
Well, Jerry, you certainly went around more than the rest of us did, but do you remember having any memorable feuds that you were involved in?
The biggest one I was ever in on a steady basis was Spears and I in Columbus. It was just done in Columbus. And then we'd go to America's and with it, but it was pretty long. It was pretty long.
Was that after Roberto Soto, or was that before that?
That was that's a good question. When was that? When did Soto and them do it?
That was started. Soto and them started in probably late 71.
Mine was after that. Yeah, it went on for a while.
With you and Ted, who would it? I know you guys had a ton of matches with Tony Charles and Les Thatcher. I mean, Les Thornton. And who did you guys work with the most? And you and Ted were together in the Carolinas, weren't you?
Yeah, we were together. We had a ton of matches with Gene and Rene Goulet. Night after night after night after night. Yeah, oh yeah. We worked with them a lot. I worked with Rene Goulet and Sweet Hansen a lot. That's somebody you didn't fool with. He hit Ted. Ted still talks about this. He hit Ted so hard back one night. I actually thought he broke his back. You know, he was just clowning with him. But I mean, I think I told y'all the story. We were in Columbia, South Carolina. I don't know if y'all ever. Down there. That was a wrestling town. That was like, it was kind of like the Augusta building, Bobby. Did you ever go to Columbia?
Yes.
That building was perfect.
Yes,
that place packed to the rafters. So Ted and I are wrestling Gene Anderson and Sweet Hansen. And Sonny Fargo's refereeing. So Sweet don't know we're going to do this. So Gene said, he told Sonny, he said, go tell those brothers, when one of them's in the ring, give Gene a turnbuckle. I mean, give Sweet a turnbuckle. He hit those turnbuckles, the ring would move. So we said, okay, told us to go down when he did it. So I was on the apron, and Ted gave Sweet a turnbuckle. Sonny Fargo went down. Gene went down on the apron, and I went down, and Ted went down. We all fell. Because the ring moved. That's how hard he hit it. And that very night, when they come out to the ring, we went next to last, and Flair was there. I forgot who he was working with. And Gene comes to the ring with that red Nature Boy robe on.
Oh, I love it.
Fargo said, hey, we're all fixing to get fired up.
I love it.
Well, speaking of Carolinas, I know Bobby had the pleasure of working with probably one of the greatest feuds up there of the 70s was Gene and Ole against Wahoo and Paul Jones.
Yeah. In there with them three different times. I put in a full day's work. The first night was an hour. The second night was an hour and a half. And the third night was an hour and 59 minutes. But, you know, Gene had a sense of humor. You had to get to know Gene.
He did.
He was quiet, and he didn't say a whole lot, but Gene was funny. He was a funny sucker.
He was a working son of a gun, too, Bobby.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I liked Ole's quote in his book. He said, Gene's idea of working was loosening a few teeth, just not knocking any out.
We was working with another tag match. It might have been Gene and Renee. And I think it was in Columbia. That was a great ring. And we kept slamming Gene. He told us, he said, I can't take another slam. We pick him up and slam. But he was great to work with. He was, everything he did was solid. He was fun. He was fun to work with.
Oh God, I'll go to bed tonight with a vision of Gene with one of them robes on.
You should have seen it.
That had to be funny.
I had to bite my lip. He's screaming.
God.
But you know, you talk about it was the Andersons against Wahoo and Jones.
Yeah.
That's the one you was talking about in Carolina?
Yeah.
Nobody ever figured that out about Jones. He was taken care of.
Oh, I'm sure.
No, he was. Listen, that used to tear there would be like Wahoo would be on a main event, and they would have a double main event, and Paul would be on one of the main events every time. There was something there with him and George that what it was, I don't know.
Well, I'm looking at the TV of the Carolinas until the end of Paul Jones' career when he became a manager and turned heel. He was definitely a hardcore fan favorite. And, you know, he did more than his share of main events.
That's what a lot of them thought. But he you know, he wasn't a good talker. He wasn't the biggest guy out there. I don't know. It was just he was
and
bigger
he was
than
the, he was the first guy. He was the first guy I ever seen use a hairdryer in a dressing room.
Well, he had that Beatles haircut, you know, dark. You know, he was going for a certain look, which was, I guess, popular at that time. But he didn't get a lot of national magazine coverage either. I mean, a guy like Wahoo did. Paul Jones didn't. I guess it's because he spent so much time in the Carolinas.
But he didn't get over here at all. Well,
he didn't. He didn't get over here in Georgia at all. And they tried.
He also worked a little in Florida. He worked a little in Florida. But the Carolinas, to my knowledge, unless anybody knows different, is the only place that he was a continuous solid main eventer. Either, you know, most tag teams was big in the Carolinas, but either he was a U.S. champion. He was usually, if he didn't have that, he was part of the tag team champion of whatever, either one of either the Mid-Atlantic or the U.S. The World, which they both had there. But as Jerry said, and you're right, people outside of the Carolinas knew very little about Paul Jones. And in the Carolinas, he was a top main eventer.
Jerry,
there's no doubt about that.
He didn't come here till George came here to book, did he?
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And he didn't stay too – he wasn't here a long time.
No, he wasn't, because George wasn't here a long time. The only thing George did here that really was a good move was he got Ric Flair. I mean, not Ric Flair. He got Roddy Piper in here.
How long was George here, Bobby?
Jerry, I'm bad about times. He wasn't here 2 years. He might not have been here a year.
No, I think he was definitely tied to George Scott, like you said.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that. Dory was going to tell me what the deal was, but when we was in Japan, but that went awry when Murdoch come up and that ended that. He was going to tell me, but I don't know. He took care of him. That's all I can tell you.
Well, Eddie Graham liked him, too, because the first time I saw him was in 72, 73. He was in Florida, but he was a heel, and he was the top heel there. And he had a long running. It had to have been 72 because it was before Briscoe won the world title. He had a long running feud with Briscoe, and he did beat Briscoe for the Florida championship. Then he won the Florida TV title on top of having a Florida title, and he took the TV title to the bridge between Tampa and St. Petersburg, threw it in the river, you know. And then I guess he was a heel for about a year and then had a big thing going with Tim Woods as well. He and Woods had a pretty good feud going. And then he and Buddy Colt were a tag team, and Buddy Colt turned on him, and that turned him babyface. And he was just as over as a babyface in Florida as he ever was as a heel. But he you're right, as far as his interviews go, he was good as a heel. He was a good interview with a heel because I think he just had that, going back to what Bob about the blow dryer in the dressing room, he had that, you know, arrogance about him naturally. So it came off better as a heel his interview style than trying to be a baby face.
Well, one of the things that probably didn't help him in Georgia was the name itself, which more than one person would be confused when they would see Paul Jones'
right.
name on the card, as confusion with the promoter. And so I think that was one of the things that didn't necessarily help him here as far as getting over, at least over the long term.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with who you work with, too.
Sure.
Bobby, was he only here when George was here?
I may be wrong, but I think so.
In the, you know, the early situation when they were really looking hard for guys and they were bringing in guys, they were reaching out to the NWA to help them fill out the card. He made a couple of appearances here, and once again, nobody knew who he was, and that was strictly Atlanta fans. But he came in then, but that was before he came in with Scott as the booker. So he was here more than once, but initially it was a short-term thing.
They were just running him down here from Charlotte to fill in the card.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
nobody knew who he was.
Yeah.
And you're right. They put Paul Jones on the card against Jay West. They would have thought the old man was putting on tights.
There you go.
That's exactly what they'd have thought.
And the funny thing was, neither one of them's real name was Paul Jones.
Well, is the young Paul Jones that we're talking about, is he still alive?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, he had he's got that Alzheimer's or something. They said he was in pretty bad shape.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they said he was pretty bad. I don't remember who told me, but they said that he was living with a daughter or son or something.
Son, I think it was here in Atlanta.
Yeah, it was. It was here, and they said that he was in pretty bad shape.
Speaking of the Alzheimer's, Jerry, you know, it's been brought up now with football players and, of course, boxers. But you know, guys of your era would be in a situation now when, based on the hits that they took with no protection whatsoever. I don't know how much of the guys of your time you stay in contact with, but have you found that to be a situation where they didn't realize that not having any kind of protection and the way they worked at the time has caused them to have memory loss now?
I'm sure, Jay, I know, and I hadn't heard anybody speak of him recently, that Tony Charles was in bad shape.
Yep, very bad. Yeah.
And that God, I heard that years ago, and I don't know how he's doing, but you're right, Jay. You know, getting licks on the head. I know, I was knocked out four times that I know, knocked out in the ring, knocked out, and you know, just hitting your head.
Mm-hmm.
On the mat or whatever, chair shots. And, you know, that's after you hearing all this other stuff, you look back and say, wait a minute now, I got hit here, I got hit there, I got knocked out there. You know, it kind of makes you wonder. But you're right. I'm sure, you know, all that.
You think about all those guys in the 50s that took hard ways. I mean, it was rampant through the Welch family, Lester, both Don and Bobby Fields before they passed away, and Buddy Paul had wound up with Alzheimer's before they passed away.
Well, you look at Nick Bockwinkel today and Vern Gagne, you know, and these were both guys that you know, you may attribute it to age, but at the same time, they worked those hard matches. And, Jerry, one more thing. Taking the kind of hits that you did and talking about being knocked out, at the time, am I correct that it was just, okay, that's part of the deal, it's pick yourself up and move on to the next town and not get x-rays and see if you head jumped up, head injury?
Absolutely. It just it was one of those deals that just went with what you did. And, you know, you take you take belly-to-back suplexes. I'm not saying you land on your head, but you come to that stop, and, that, and your brain's moving in there, even like a body slam. I mean,
even running into like the turnbuckle. You're going from 25
exactly.
miles an hour to zero, and everything inside is still moving.
It's just like Dr. Andrews told me. He said, your body is not made to do what y'all do.
There you go.
So you think about Harley and all those head butts off the top rope.
Oh, my God.
And Harley's riding around on a little scooter and can't remember squat.
Yep.
Are you kidding me, Bobby?
He wasn't at Call Fire last year. He was there, not this year, but he was there last year. He's riding a little scooter, and buddy, there's a lot of things he don't remember.
You're kidding me.
No.
I heard Junior was like that too.
Yeah, could be. What was your name again?
I don't remember a lot of stuff. It's not from that, but just
look,
a thing.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm just saying, I go to these reunions religiously. I mean, it is important to me. But every year I go, I see somebody that's a year older that is not what they were the year before. Maybe there is something to the concussions and all that stuff, but Jerry hit the nail on the head. I tatered myself more hitting the mat than anybody ever did hitting me. You overcompensate or you land wrong. And no, you didn't go get x-rays because somebody would have your job the next night. You sucked it up, went home, pull a lice on it, made the next town.
Right.
But until Jay just mentioned that, I really never thought too much about it. But,
yeah,
you know,
me neither.
Like you said, the turnbuckles, the slams, the suplexes. But, you know, y'all always kid me about going to the reunion. I went to one in Mobile, and when I left there, I said to myself, I'll never go to another one. That was the most depressing thing that I'd seen.
It's sad in a lot of ways, isn't it?
It's depressing, Bobby. I was brokenhearted when I left there.
I leave those reunions. I talked to Kelly about this in Las Vegas. He was with us almost every step we took there. He stayed with us all day, and we ate supper at night together, and we were talking, and I told him, I said, you know, every year I leave those reunions, and I said, I can't help it. I cannot help it. I go, who's not going to be here next year? And you take this year, for instance. I would never in my life have imagined that Joe Turner would have went as fast as he did.
That's what I'm talking about.
You just don't know. You just don't know. It's.
I walked into that reunion, and I was sitting there watching guys come in. Who is that guy? Who is that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. I saw Frankie Kane. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. You know, I'm going, this ain't for me, man. This is, you got something fixed in your mind, and it's not what you thought it was. And I left there, and it bothered me for a couple of months. That's why I've never been back.
Well, you have to, you know, we remember them like they were. And, you know, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I do. Because there's times I see people that just, you know. And sometimes, I'll give you a good example. Roger Smith, first time I saw Roger Smith in 25 years, I didn't know who he was. And Roger looks good, but I just, you know, he had that red hair last time I saw him. And, of course, hair's not red anymore, but... you have your picture in your mind of what they were, and they're not like that
exactly.
anymore.
Exactly.
And it breaks your heart. Especially, I mean, you're the same boat I'm in, Jerry. You're a fan. And, you know, even though you spent all these years in the business, you're still a fan at heart.
Absolutely.
I told Michael the other day or somebody I was talking to, I would really like to go back in my mind or in my heart back to before I smartened up to the business. When I enjoyed it so much and thought they were killing each other, because I lived for it, and I don't know. Like I say, I see them every year, and you just it's just a little different. And
Jerry, we can't all be like you and Charlie Smith and be found the Fountain of Youth. You had an Avery. And I was in Mobile that year you came. And, of course, I saw you a couple times when I went down for your show. You haven't changed that much.
Well, I guess, you know, I've always taken care of myself, and I was proud when I was doing it. And I still weigh. I weigh 235. I got a 35-inch waist. I got like 19-inch arms, 20-inch neck still. I still work out. I mean, even like with my job, people know who I am, you know, from, oh, that's that guy that come down here. He was a wrestler. And I just have pride in me, you know, and what
yeah.
I did. And, you also and I'll,
didn't,
I'll have,
you know, you didn't do the drinking and the drug and that stuff's where it's years, people. You know,
oh,
not
please.
Just the traveling and everything else, but the you know, you just can't, you know, get drunk every night for 25 years and it not affect you somewhere along the line.
Well,
you
I know, saw a picture of Slater when they had that fan fest thing in Atlanta. I didn't know who he was.
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, if you look, I saw a survey not too long ago at the guys of the 60s and, you know, the 60s and the 70s era that worked, that did the every night traveling, ate bad food, drank more than they should, partied, didn't eat like they should, the whole business. But when you compare them to the guys of the 80s, 90s that were so heavily into the steroids that those guys have gone much quicker than the guys from the 60s and the 70s.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And you
that's
know, that,
because the
that's
guys
another,
from the 60s are pickled. They're not preserved.
That's right. It's another comparison that's being made about lifestyle. But, Jerry, you know, it's, you know, I've noticed the same thing when you I look at my idols from the late 50s to the probably mid 70s that were in the music business, and how some of them have seemed like they've got eternal youth, and others, you know, can't work anymore, even though they could if they were in the physical shape to do it. Some people just have bad luck, and you can't help that, but a great deal of them just had to live that persona, and by doing so, they basically just destroyed themselves.
I tell
well,
you one
and
it
like,
would absolutely break your heart if you saw him now is Ken Lucas. You know, because Ken
really?
Always kept himself in good shape.
Yeah.
And Ken can't even walk anymore. He has to be
I'm
carried.
Kidding me, Mike.
No, that's
nope.
Jerry. I never crossed paths with Ken Lucas. Don't know how I missed him, but I never crossed paths with him. I did not meet him. I met Ken Lucas when Ann Bowman died. And they had to introduce me to him. I had no idea who he was. Had no idea. And he was still walking at that time, and but now he's, I mean, the sense of humor's there. The joking's still there. His health's kind of gone south on him. And I'm not saying this is an excuse, but, you know, his son was in a horrible traffic accident, laid in a nursing home for a couple of years and died. And Ken, you know, Ken stayed by his side day and night almost, and I'm sure that took a great toll on him. But, yeah, it's just when we were in Mobile for Joe Turner's service, they told us that Ken was in a rehab facility in Pensacola.
Are you kidding me?
No.
No.
How bad is he, Mike?
Well, I know, and I haven't seen Ken in a couple of years now, but whenever he was going up to Scott Teal's, he couldn't climb steps. They had to physically pick him up and carry him in the house. And the last reunion, of course, I was in the hospital, so I didn't get to go in Mobile. The first one Ken came to, and he was in a wheelchair, wasn't he? Bobby, was he on a walker?
I'm here. I'm sorry.
He was listening to the clock in the background to see what time it was, whether Debbie had a show coming up.
9 o'clock.
Yep.
Yeah, we had to. We actually picked him up. He sat in a chair, and we picked him up and toted him up 4 or 5 steps at Scott's house. I mean,
Mobile, was he in a wheelchair or was he on a walker?
He was in a wheelchair in Mobile.
Are you kidding me?
No, Joe went and picked him up.
If I'd have been there, I'd probably left.
It's sad. It's sad. But
it's,
you know, like I say, Jerry, the sense of humor's there. Everything's there. It's just a fact where he's getting older. And like I say, I don't know that the son had them, but it had to take a toll on him.
Well, sure it did.
Well, Ken's had it. I mean,
you know,
Ken lost his wife and both his parents
daughter
for them
too.
For 1 year. Daughter, yeah. And then he, after Eddie Sullivan, who was his best friend, you know, he lost Eddie. And then he started, about a year after Eddie passed away, he started seeing Eddie's widow. And they were dating, and in fact, they were talking about getting married. Ken was going to move to back out to Phoenix and live with her. And she all of a sudden died.
Yeah, Barbara died.
Yeah. So it's been rough, but he's still Ken Lucas to me. He'll always
listen. Let me give you. You know, Jerry, you know how he is on Practical Jokes.
Oh,
I got
to
give you this one, Joe Turner. This was Joe Turner's probably the last good thing Joe Turner ribbed on. Ken went to the bathroom. And he had on a pair of sweatpants. And when he come back out, for whatever reason, he didn't pull them all the way up, and he was exposed across the top of his sweatpants.
Come on, man.
So somebody come over to me and said, you know, you need to go over and tell Ken that, you know, he needs to fix his pants. He's exposed, and all them women's walking up over there and hugging him and talking to him. And so I stood up and started over, and Joe Turner cut me off. Joe said, don't tell him. I'll take care of it. So Joe just sat over there and watched the entertainment.
Knowing Ken Lucas, he did it on purpose.
He probably did it on purpose.
Oh, I hate to hear that. But you know, Jay brought up a good thing about, you know, do we ever go get checked and, you know, like the licks to the head and all. But, you know, it's like all the stuff that we did, I mean, we don't do, you know, do stuff like Cactus Jack coming off cages and, you know, and all that crazy stuff. But he's paying for it now, and he's a young man. But it was the every night doing it, you know.
Yep.
And then this, the accumulation, it's not the one slam or the one suplex. It's the many, many, many. How many times you get slammed in a match, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You never got an opportunity to heal from whatever injury you got.
And you're young, and, you know, you're resilient. And I know when I was out there in Louisiana, you're on the main event every night, traveling 3,000 miles a week. And honestly, you really believe that you're bulletproof.
Yes, sir.
As long as you keep the pace up, you don't notice it as much.
I tell people every day when my knees hurt or my back hurts, or I'm paying for thinking I'm Superman for 20 years.
That's it. But the thing about it is, I mean, I always took care of myself, worked out, tried to watch what I eat, even on the road, took care of myself. But the accumulation of all this stuff, that, you know, I've had double knee replacement. I've got my right shoulder, it's so bad. When I went to my last appointment for my knees, I told the doctors, look at my shoulder while I'm here. I said, my shoulder's frozen up. He said, yeah, you got a frozen shoulder, and he x-rayed it. He come back in there, and he said, nothing I can do for it. I said, what are you talking about? I thought I had a torn rotator cuff or something. He said, the ball of your shoulder, the socket in there, the ball, he said, you got a flat spot on there. He said, there's nothing I can do about it. I said, look, man, this thing kills me. He said, the only option you have is a shoulder replacement.
Oh,
and he said, your life as you know it is you working out and you taking care of yourself. He said, you're in great shape. He says, your life as you know it will be over. I said, you can forget that. I said, I'll live with it. He said, if I replace your shoulder and you continue to work out like you're working out, you'll come back through these doors in 2 years. And he said, you'll kill me. I said, I'll just have to live with it. So I live with it, and I work around it. I work out, do things that don't aggravate it so much. But as I don't stop working out because my shoulder hurt. You know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's like my brother. I mean, Ted, he's had knee surgeries. He's got a plate on, titanium plate on both sides of his neck. He's had back surgery. And you know, as time goes on, you know, if you don't, which he doesn't go to the gym, he don't work out, he don't, you know, Dr. Andrews told me one time, he said, motion is lotion. If you don't use this stuff and keep it going as much as you can, then there you have it. You see, like you said, Bobby, you go to reunions and you see guys in wheelchairs.
Yeah, Debbie's, my wife's arthritis was so bad.
I can't even, I think about
she
her
would, she would
all
come
the time,
home.
Bobby. I want you to know that. I think about your wife.
She would come home, Jerry, from work. She worked in the film industry. She was a, she edited movie film, mounted movie film, and that sort of stuff. She would come home, and she would just be almost in tears where her hands would be hurting. And her rheumatologist told her, he said, you know, you need to quit. You need to go to get on disability, but I don't want you to quit. And I looked at him, and he said, if she quits, I'm afraid it's going to get worse. He said, she is moving those hands every day.
Just what I told you.
And when her business, when that, her business actually folded out from under her, and they, you know, her, it just wasn't there anymore. It just went away. The industry changed so much that they did something else. But, you know, that's when she started getting worse, is when she quit working every day. And you know, that's, you're right. You need to, you have to keep going. That's, you know, I get up, I don't work out, but I get up and go to work every day, you know, and do what I got to do. And that's just, that's the way it is. And I, you know, I'm just, I'm thankful to, you know, we talk about all of this, and we kind of got off on a kind of a depressing track here tonight, thinking about all the stuff that we do. But, you know, the sad part is if we were 45 years younger and had the same opportunity, we'd pack our bags and climb in our cars.
Absolutely.
And say, where's the first stop?
Because we all grew up fans, and we wanted in the business, and we loved it so much that we would have done anything. I mean, you know, look how many times I took beatings on TV and never even got to even do anything other than go out there
and
and
the you know, the thing is you know, and
business.
People look at us like we're crazy. When I started, the guarantee was $15. And you can tell me all day long, gas was $29.30 a gallon. That's wonderful. It was still only
$15.
You know, and hey, was tickled to death to get it.
You were professional.
That was if you didn't work for Gulus. Gulus, I think the guarantee was a ham sandwich or something.
No. Well,
but I had somebody ask me
doing
Monday.
Turnbuckles last. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hey, somebody asked me Monday. I was down at Tybee, and some guy said, Russell? I said, yeah, I wrestled for a while, yeah, you know, pretty good while. And he said, do you miss it? I said, I miss it every day of my life.
Oh,
every day. And for what, you know, I guess I'm thankful. I've been blessed. I am thankful. I'm blessed that, you know, only my knees are really, you know, which they're like brand new now, but other than my shoulder, I mean, I'm stiff in the mornings when I get up and like the rest of us. But
you're stiff 25 years ago.
You know what? That's what they said. I've heard that before.
I can attest to it. But anyway, never mind. I'm sorry.
But I would do it again, but I would do it a little bit different. I would do things probably a little bit different.
Yeah,
I mean, when I started, nobody wore knee pads. I didn't start wearing knee pads until my knees were shot. Harley Race told me one time, he said, Daddy, I'll never wear those knee pads. Well, once you wear them, you'll never go in the ring without them again. You know, everybody started wearing them. Of course, Briscoe never wore them, and Funk never, Dory never wore them. But
Danny Hodge,
just little things, you know.
Freddie Blassie wore them.
Yeah.
And I never saw a match with Freddie Blassie after he was what you'd call senior, where he didn't have both knees protected. But Roberto Soto was a young guy. He wore the knee pads, too, and I knew his knees were in bad shape even early. But, you looked at it as a knee pad as something that you would wear after you had the injury, not to protect yourself from an injury. And,
right.
That was the approach at that time.
But you know why I wore them? I didn't wear them to because I had bad knees or anything. I wore them to keep from getting mat burns.
Well, that makes sense, too, as long as you can
keep them from doing that.
I'll tell you the best thing I ever come across, and I didn't come across it till late in my career, and I can attribute this to Mr. Oates because he got it for me because he had one, and I seen it and loved it. And I don't even know what they're made out of, but I still got two back here in my drawer that I've still got that if I have to go do something extraneous with my legs, I wear them.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
They're neoprene or neo whatever they were. They come from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. I can tell you right where they come from on the lake.
That's exactly.
Them
exactly.
Stretch. I mean, those are the best things I ever come across.
I still got two pair brand new ones. I've worn them the last... when I was promoting, but they still look like brand new, and I still got them.
Yeah. Those things.
Those were the most unbelievable things I ever got a hold of.
Years ago, I mean, this is going back now 20 years, I used to bowl in a league with my mother and a couple of my uncles and an aunt. And my left knee, which is where the pressure was when I was bowling, it would kill me. I mean, it would kill me at night. And I thought about that thing, and I thought, man, I need to wear that. And I started wearing it, and, you know, it didn't hurt anymore.
Wow.
Well, it just keeps that compression on it.
Yes,
you know?
Sir. It wasn't a knee pad. It was like a compression fitting over your knee.
And then I'd wear knee pads over that.
Over those.
After I had all my surgeries.
Yeah.
And they helped. I'm telling you, they helped.
Well, Jerry, when you were in Mobile, did you ever work with Frank Dalton? Do you remember?
You know, I worked with Frank somewhere, Mike, but...
I know the first night you were in Mobile, you teamed with him. But
I'm
going back
sure
to what we were talking about, you know, the turnbuckle spots and everything. Fargo broke Frank in the business. He was kind of a buddy of Frank's, or, I mean, of Fargo's, when Jim Dalton left the Daltons. And Fargo trained him and got him in the business as Frank Dome. He's the one that gave him that name. But he and Kelly were real close when they were all in Louisiana. And he and Kelly stayed close until Frank died. But they did something taping TV in Lafayette. And Kelly was refereeing, and Frank, I don't know who Frank was working with. But Frank always took a weird... run into the turnbuckle whenever they did that spot. He would leave his feet about 5 feet out from the turnbuckle. And
I know what you're talking about.
And he was, you know, because he was kind of short anyway, and he was a smaller guy, but he would make that turn and jump into the air. Well, he overdid it during this TV match, and the back of his head hit the ring post.
Oh, jeez.
And I take that back. It wasn't a television. It was a Friday night or whatever, the night before, where it was. He was supposed to do television the next day, and he didn't show up. So Kelly went to the hotel where he was staying and finally got into his room, and he was unconscious. He wound up, he was pretty much in a coma. And when he came out of the coma, he was paralyzed on his left side. And he was paralyzed for the remainder of his career. Eventually he got more feeling in it, but he never had full feeling in his left side, all from that one spot. And he still continued to take that crazy bump. Every time I ever saw a Frank Dalton match, you could almost bet he was going to go out of the ring at some point. He'd get thrown out of the ring at some point because that was his thing to do. Because you know he was kind of like Cactus Jack before Cactus Jack. But
you know,
just tell you, you know, that could be something that you do all the time. But all it takes is one miscalculation.
That's
bang.
All it takes. But you know, all the years I spent in the business, even after I come off the road full time, I was doing tons of wrestling. I mean, I was going somewhere every week, overseas, and I was going to Kansas City. I was going to Detroit. I was going here. I was going there. Working here in for the office here. I mean, I was wrestling 3 or 4, 5 times a week. And, you know, I never, ever saw anybody get seriously injured, you know, like a... Now, I know Bobby Garrett was working with Flair on Atlanta TV, and Garrett broke his arm. But you know, I never saw anything like that. Did you, Bobby?
No.
I saw
nothing.
Were you remember when Angelo Mosca tore his shoulder? It seemed like it was a 6-man tag at the Omni.
Yeah.
And, you know, he went down, and I forget who the referee was. I think maybe it was Scrappy. But anyway, he said, I don't know if I can finish the match or not. And it was, you know, when he hit, he tore it pretty bad. And the match was over quicker than it should have been. But that was probably the worst in-ring injury that I was ever sitting close to ringside where I, you know, which was legit that happened that didn't mean to while the match was taking place.
I know Dr. Andrews operated on his shoulder.
Yeah.
But you would see guys hurt their knees or maybe, like you said, not as severe as Angelo, hurt their shoulder or hurt their neck. But all that stuff adds up, though, whether you tore it bad enough to have surgery or not. Just once you ever hurt something bad, it's never the same, I'm telling you. It's never, ever the same. But I was fortunate. I never saw, you know, a guy get his, you know, I separated the shoulder one night in Columbus. In the same night, Paul Ellering tore his patella tendon. We both went to the emergency room that night. Stuff like that, but nothing I'm talking about, you know, like some guy getting paralyzed or breaking his leg or.
Yeah, I never. But, you know, the thing was, we would do things sometimes on the spur of the moment and wouldn't think about it. It was sort of like a second nature or instinct, whatever the situation called for, whether it was a, you know, a backdrop or a, you know, I mean, just, you know, when I think of backdrops, I think of Ted, you know.
Oh, my God.
Ted was the dumber of the Oates brothers, I guess. Ted's back. Ted had a bad back, and it would go out on him. And I mean, I've seen him get in the ring where he could barely walk. I mean, just in horrible pain. And the first thing he'd do is call a backdrop.
I've seen him do it 100 times.
Yeah, and I mean, he'd hit, and then he'd look up at you, and he'd go, "It went in," you know. But it could have just as easily went the other way.
I know one night I was, it's funny how, like you said, instinct. I was in Kansas City one night. I'm working with Terry Funk. This is right before he got the belt. And we was going to do an hour. And I was burning up with a fever. I mean, I was sick. I was sick as a dog. I was sick. And it was winter time. I stayed dressed until it was time to put my stuff on. That's how sick I was. And Geigel said, "Man, can you do this?" I said, "I can do it." I said, "I'll do it." And I'm a son of a gun. It's like, as sick as I was, you're burning up with a fever, but you're freezing. And when I got to the ring and I hooked up with Funk, he said, "Man, you're on fire." And did you know I did an hour? It's like I'm supposed to do this. I have to do this.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when that bell rings and that bell's for you,
mm-hmm.
you're like a fire horse. You know,
mm-hmm.
you got to go. I don't know, but Jay did bring up a good thing. You know, a lot of stuff we probably should have had checked out, and like especially like Frank Dalton hitting his head like that. And,
yeah.
And he could have died.
I refereed one night in Carrollton. I was sick as a dog. I was throwing up in a bucket in the dressing room. I was 18 years old. And you know, you don't say I can't work, I'm sick. You know, you didn't do that.
No, we went. We went.
I went out to work that night, and I was sick all day Sunday. So Monday I got up and went to the – I had the measles. It's a wonder I didn't infect all the guys and everybody in the building over there.
I know one night when we was in Charlotte, I had hurt my back working out. I mean, bad. I mean, talking about bad. So Ted drove to the town. I laid in the back seat all the way to the town. We were working with Renee and Gene. And did you know Ted Oates had to put my boots on me and lace them up? I couldn't even bend over and do it. And I went out there. I sent word over there to him. I said, tell them my back is screwed up. Soon as Ted started the match, stayed as long as he could. As soon as he tagged me, I go in the, I come in the ring, and Rene Goulet gives me a flying mare. And that was, you know, I had no more business doing that than Man in the Moon. But like Bobby said, you didn't say, hey, I can't make it tonight.
Right.
You just didn't do it. You didn't do it.
No.
I don't know. Why didn't we do it, Bobby?
We're afraid we wouldn't have a spot the next night.
Yeah, you thought somebody else had it.
I mean, you know, that's a fact. And the sad part is we probably wouldn't have. They'd have found somebody else.
There you go.
You know, they were so coveted. Those spots were so coveted. And it ain't like now where they got unions or whatever they got, and if they twist their little pinky, they take 2 weeks off.
And the contracts. Don't forget the contracts.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It was just, oh, jeez.
Well, guys, we've come to let me bring us to a brief stopping point here. I need to get in another commercial word. Our Peach State Pandemonium podcast tonight is happy to be sponsored by Audible.com, which is a leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing is on right now. If you go to their website and sign up, their website is audibletrial.com/GWH radio. You can get one free audio book and a 1 month free trial of that service. So anybody interested that listens to audio books or whatever, give that site a shot. But going back to the worst thing, and I had, of course, this happened before, I won't say before my time because I was alive, but I was certainly not in the business by it. But the worst thing I've ever heard of, Bob Kelly told me about something that happened to Lee Fields when they were working in Louisiana. And even though Lee was a promoter, he still wrestled. He did a thing where he got thrown out of the ring or something, and there was a bolt sticking up. It went right through his head. And, of course, they took him to the hospital, all that stuff, and he's thinking like a promoter now. He worked that into an angle because he came back with his head bandaged, you know, the next day on TV or whatever, and did a thing with the Daltons where they busted him open again. Of course, he was a promoter, so I'm sure he paid himself the $15 extra for doing the hard way.
What happened to him, to Lee? What was
Lee?
His demise?
When he passed
happened?
Away?
Yeah.
He died of leukemia.
Did he really?
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, he bought that racetrack. Well, he was still promoting wrestling. He bought the racetrack in 71 or 72 where we had the reunion now. And after he got out of the business, he continued to run that racetrack. It was nothing for you to be driving down Highway 90 and go past a racetrack, and he's out there on his tractor cutting grass.
Yeah, he started that, and he got the drag strip. He started the drag strip.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Yeah, I didn't know what happened to him.
Yep. They're all gone now. All three of the Fields brothers are gone now.
And, that's Evelyn and Don and Bobby's wives are gone. And Lee's wife, Ada, is still with us.
Yep.
And that generation's...
You know, that's continuing along the depression trek that we're on. You look at the list, and, you know, as you're a young guy, whether it's your family members or people in your profession or people that you watch in a profession, and you see yourself at the bottom of the list, and as time goes on, it starts to get a little scary because all of a sudden there's nobody ahead of you. And that means that you're next. You know, I mean, it's there's some humor in it. It's gallows humor, but at the same time, you've thought all these years about the folks that went before you, and you never really put that much into the fact that how you were moving up. And it's just a fact of life, you know, death is, and I think the point I'm trying to get here is it's inevitable, but at the same time, there's things that you can do to speed that up, and then there's other things, like Jerry was talking about, that you can do to kind of not only perpetuate life, but to make the time you have better, you know, whether it be spiritually or physically. And that's certainly something that I've tried to, even though I'm not saying I'm doing a great job at it, but I'm, you know, trying to do every day.
Well, it got to be, again, a gallows humor, but it got to be a running joke at the Mobile reunion for 3 or 4 years that whoever came to the reunion with Ronnie Garvin wasn't going to be there the next year. Nelson Royal, Tim Woods, Sandy Scott,
they all
came down with Ronnie, and the next year they were gone. So I don't think Ronnie can get anybody to ride with him anymore. I think, well, he's, the last few years he's been bringing Rick McCord with him. I guess nobody's told Rick about riding with Ronnie, from what I understand, would be enough.
That'll scare you.
That'll get your heart pumping anyway. I mean, I never rode with him, but I've had him pass me doing 150 in the emergency lane on the right side, so you know.
Well, don't ride with him, that's all I can tell you. Well, guys, this is about all I can stand. I got to get up early in the morning.
Jerry is about as depressed as he can get for one night.
This is the...
He's really happy to have been here this evening.
Yeah, don't go jump out the window or nothing.
No.
And hopefully we'll all be in as good enough shape to be here next week for you, dear.
We're going to be. Well, Bobby may not be with us. He's got vacation Bible school next week.
Well, I'll check in from the road next week. I don't know how long I can stay, but I'll check in.
All right.
We'll do that, Bobby.
Okay. I appreciate it as always. I was a little hesitant about coming back because I wasn't sure how well I'd do after such a long time off, but it's been fun.
Glad you're back.
I've enjoyed this as bad as it was. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too.
Great.
All right,
well, all this stuff is a fact, though, you know?
Yep.
It's a fact.
Don't be chasing any snakes tomorrow, Jerry.
Don't worry about that, sir.
All right, guys. Well, we will get together next week and do this again. I appreciate all you guys as always, and we'll talk next week.
Okay.
All right. Good night, guys.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.